Blog Talk Radio.
And now we're live, not just with Facebook, but with the Vibe Radio Network, too.
Yes, yeah. Woohoo.
So, yeah, we are all good to go tonight. So.
Yeah, we are talking pop culture inspirations for horror stories and characters in various genres. And
something a little different tonight.
Yeah, there's a few places that we're going to talk about that actually do have ghosts, but we're just talking about mostly the inspirational stuff.
Yes.
Kind of fun because everybody maybe sometimes wonders, oh, where did the character of Chucky come from? Which we talked about a while ago when we talked about haunted dolls the very first time, and that was Robert the doll that inspired Chucky. We may be seeing soon.
Maybe. We'll see.
We'll see. Anyway.
But yeah, so yeah, the idea is, yeah, there's all kinds of scary stuff out there, not necessarily ghosts, but all kinds of real world scary stories and events and whatnot that have inspired some of the most famous pop culture horror stuff of our time. So
that's what we're going to look at.
Yeah, we're going to give this a try, and we hope that you'll let us know what you think. Either this is going to be really cool, or this could...
Or we'll go back to ghost stories next
week
from now.
Well, I mean, we got ghost stories for 2 weeks from now, but we'll see if we revisit this genre again. But, yeah, so...
Because we like really cool history stuff.
Yeah, and I think this first one's a good one to start with.
Yeah, this is Chris's favorite character, and like I said, this is my favorite character to beat in Diablo.
Yes, two. Oh, I need to get this. Here. I need to get this going up on so I can chat with you all, too.
Okay, I'm going to drink before I start talking.
Okay.
I see Patrick messaged. I can't quite read it.
Good to see you all again. Inspiration for popular characters in horror. This should be fun. We hope so. Hopefully I didn't screw it up.
All right.
Because, yeah, I wound up throwing together most of the script.
I did the basic research. He made it sound good.
Good. We'll see. You be the judge. So, anyway, the first place that we're going to start is actually, we're going to start with the true story here of a woman in Eastern Europe who goes by the name of Countess Elizabeth Báthory, a Hungarian noblewoman from the noble family of Báthory. Imagine that. Very noble concept.
That's where they had the same name as the family in this area. Easy to remember.
Yep. Now, she owned land in the Kingdom of Hungary, which now today comprises Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania. So we're going back, we're talking centuries here, back to the late 1500s, early 1600s. Now, Báthory has been labeled by Guinness Book of World Records as the most prolific female murderer, though the precise number of her victims is debatable. Báthory and four collaborators were accused of torturing and killing hundreds of young girls and women between 1590 and 1610, with the highest number of victims cited during Báthory's trial at 650.
Wow.
Yeah. The stories of Báthory's sadistic serial murders were verified by the testimonial of more than 300 witnesses and survivors, as well as physical evidence and the presence of horribly mutilated, dead, dying, and imprisoned girls found at the time of her arrest. Evidence sounds pretty darn convincing out of the gate, but we shall see. Now, stories describing Báthory's vampiric tendencies, such as the tale that she bathed in the blood of virgins and to retain her youth, were generally recorded years after her death. While these tales are generally considered unreliable, her story quickly became part of national folklore, and her infamy persists to this day. Some insist that she was actually the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula, and nicknames and literary epithets attributed to her include the Blood Countess and Countess Dracula. Now, what is known is that as a child, Báthory suffered multiple seizures that may have been caused by epilepsy. At the time, symptoms relating to epilepsy were diagnosed as falling sickness, and included blood of a non-sufferer on the lips of an epileptic, giving the epileptic a mix of non-sufferer's blood and a piece of skull. Their episode ended. This has led to speculation that killings during her later part of her life were part of her efforts to cure the illness she had been suffering from since childhood. Regardless of the circumstances, in December of 1610, authorities went to the castle that she lived in and arrested Báthory along with four of her servants who were accused of being her accomplices. According to the authorities, their unannounced visit visits found one dead girl and another living as prey in the castle. Despite the evidence against Bathory, her family's importance kept her from facing execution. A trial and execution would have caused a public scandal, and an influential family which rules Transylvania would be disgraced. She was imprisoned in December of 1610 within her castle, yes, the same castle where she was arrested, as a form of strict house arrest. She was detained in the castle for the rest of her life, where she died in August of 1614 at the age of 54. She was initially buried at the local church, but according to some sources, due to the villagers' uproar over having the countess buried in their cemetery, her body was moved to her birth home at Assid, where it was interred at the Bathory family crypt. The location of her body today is unknown, as no known grave marker remains. In modern times, scholars still argue over the veracity of the charges against Bathory. Several scholars have argued that Elizabeth Bathory was a victim of a conspiracy, with some saying that the proceedings against Bathory were largely politically motivated, possibly due to her extensive wealth and ownership of large areas of land in Hungary. The case has inspired numerous stories and fairy tales. In the 18th and 19th century, writers liberally added or omitted elements of the narrative. The most common motif for these works was that the countess bathed in her victim's blood in order to remain, you know, youthful and beautiful. Frequently, the cruel countess would discover the secret of bathing blood when she slapped the female servant in rage, splashing parts of her own skin with blood. Upon removal of the blood, that portion of skin would seem younger and more beautiful than before. All of the early stories do rely on the idea that the countess needed specific personal motivation to account for her bloodlust, in her case, personal vanity. It is not until more recent years when some began to admit that the countess may have been motivated by pure sadistic pleasure. Truth aside, tales of the blood countess have inspired many pop culture references into the modern day. The Bathory story has been an inspiration for too many novels to count, but a few that you might be familiar with. There is Dracula the Undead by Dracula Stoker. Yes, this is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker. And he wrote a book, Dracula the Undead, where the Countess appeared as the main villain in that tale. There's also To Love a Vampire by Robert Stadler. A vampiric Bathory encounters a young Van Helsing during his days as a medical student. Sounds like a fun twist on things.
Yeah.
And then there's Demoness by Martin Cage. Here, Bathory is depicted as one of the reincarnations of the demoness Lilith. So going back and getting your biblical stuff on.
Yes.
Now, the tales of the Blood Countess has also been told by Hollywood time and time again. Just a few of the examples are Countess Dracula back in 1971, Bathory, Countess of Blood in 2008, The Countess in 2009, Lady of Celeste, which is the name of the castle that she lived in 2015. There are more, and you will be forgiven for not knowing any of their names because many of them were critical flops, and you will be hard-pressed to find them outside the archives of IMDb today. Now, one of our personal favorites, though, that Patrick hinted to right at the very beginning, is we have Diablo II. Now, Diablo II, if you're not familiar, it is a video game. That's been around
for a while.
24 years
that I want to count.
About 20 years is when it was released. And there is a very overt reference to the Blood Countess in it. It starts when you find a document called the Moldy Tome. Kind of very generic, but it reads, "And so it came to pass that the Countess, who once bathed in the rejuvenating blood of 100 virgins, was buried alive. And her castle, in which so many cruel deeds took place, rapidly fell into ruin. Rising over the buried dungeons in that godforsaken wilderness, a solitary tower, like some monument to evil, is all that remains. The Countess's fortune was believed to be divided among the clergy, although some say that more remains to be found. Still buried alongside the rotting skulls that bear mute witness to the inhumanity of the human creature." So, this does very much echo the folklore surrounding Bathory, where you have bathing in the blood to extend her youth, buried alive in her castle, house arrest kind of type thing, and narrowly avoided having her wealth seized by the authorities. in the end, your task as the hero is to hunt down the Countess and claim her treasure as your own.
Killer.
Of course, you're ridding the land of evil as well.
Yes.
So there's other Blood Countess-inspired video game characters, which the Castlevania franchise has a character called Elizabeth Bartley, who is definitely based off Elizabeth Bathory. Dragon Age Origins, there was a character called the Baroness who abducts and kills young female villagers and uses their blood for rejuvenating rituals. Definitely very much the Countess. And then, actually, Mass Effect, which you wouldn't kind of think goes in there. Mass Effect. Sci-fi futuristic franchise. But there is a human plastic surgeon that kills 30 aliens to harvest the genetic compounds that slows the aging process and allows the aliens to live for about 1,000 years. The surgeon's name, Elizabeth, which is the Hungarian form of Elizabeth. So, very short thread there. We could go on and on, and actually we could do an entire episode on the Blood Countess. And maybe we will one day. But tonight is not that night because we have many other rep-hop references to get to. But you can go on and you can find references to the Blood Countess in comics, stage plays, television, toys. She has been all over the place, music even.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, it's safe to say they haven't seen the last of the Blood Countess in pop culture.
No, she's just a fun character, fascinating woman in history. I mean, you have a Guinness World Book record from the 1500s.
So that goes.
I don't want anybody to ever beat that.
Please don't. Please don't try.
Yeah. So I noticed we had quite a few comments on there. Do you want to take a quick look?
So far, so good. Yay! Elizabeth Bathory was incredibly vindictive. Absolutely, she most certainly was.
And the falling sickness, if you guys are Shakespeare references, Caesar claimed he has the falling sickness. Cassius is the one who says that, and again, it's referring to Caesar, and it was known he had epilepsy. So this is something that is all throughout our literature and our history.
No questions.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going to jump right into The Exorcist, because why not? So in 1971, author William Peter Blatty set out to write a nonfiction novel about events that took place in St. Louis, Missouri in 1949. The event deeply pierced the worlds of Roman Catholicism and the human psyche, along with some of the details that were lost to time, privacy concerns, dramatization, and the core of this tale still holds true today.
No, we're good.
All right, so in mid-1949, several newspaper articles printed anonymous reports of an alleged possession and exorcism. The word alleged is key here, as many of the witnesses to this event took the details to their graves. Those that were willing to talk were unwilling to do so on the record. According to the diary of priest Father Raymond J. Bishop, identified the young man by the pseudonym Ronald Doe, a.k.a. Robbie. Now, Robbie was reportedly part of a German family that lived in College Park, Maryland in the 1940s, but the family moved to South Africa for a number of years, and during this time, Robbie had no other children to play with. So he came to rely on the adults in his family to play with, and it was during this time that his Aunt Harriet introduced Robbie to a Ouija board. No.
Ouija board.
No.
Bad. Haunts of Richmond does not endorse the use of Ouija boards.
Not at all.
Not at all.
All right. Say
that every single time.
After the family moved back to the United States, Aunt Harriet passed away, and the family started to experience strange noises, moving furniture, and levitating objects. The family turned to their pastor, who suspected that Robbie might be the source of those occurrences. The pastor advised that the boy needed to see a Catholic priest. Allegedly, the boy underwent numerous exorcisms, and during one at Georgetown University Hospital, the boy managed to slip a restraint, broke a bed spring from the mattress, and slashed the arm of one of the attending priests. The ritual was halted, and the family was referred to St. Louis University and the college church there. There, an associate of the church, William Bowderin, observed the phenomenon himself, and he obtained permission from the bishop to perform another rite of exorcism. This time, the exorcism took place at the Alexander Brothers Hospital in St. Louis. Bowderin was joined by two other priests, Walter Halloran and William Van Roo. During this ritual, they observe the words evil and hell appear on the boy's body, along with other various markings. Allegedly, the boy's mattress also shook, and Robbie managed to break Halloran's nose during the ritual. After the rite ended, Robbie supposedly went on to live an ordinary life and supposedly retired from NASA about 10 to 15 years ago. Now, many have tried to debunk the exorcism with these claims that Robbie suffered from a mental illness or that the whole ordeal was an outright hoax. The hospital doctors have also been criticized for allowing the rites to take place within their facility walls. Though there were some in the medical community that believed that the power of suggestion has curative properties. Even though they do not believe in the science of exorcisms themselves, regardless, there's no debate about the fact that this inspired a truly horrifying piece of literature and the associated movies. Now, during Blatty's During Blatty's research into what was intended to be a nonfiction novel, Blatty hit numerous factual walls and protests from those he was interviewing. The biggest change was that Robbie was changed to a girl to help protect the boy's identity, and the novels and subsequent movies were also both set in Washington, D.C., as opposed to St. Louis. As Blatty first heard the tale of the exorcism while he was a student at Georgetown University in 1950. Many other artistic liberties were ultimately taken through the process to come up with the final product as we know it today. Now, some fun facts and truths about the exorcism and the fiction behind the exorcist. St. Louis University's College Church rectory was torn down in 1966, and the university doesn't say much about any paranormal occurrences that happen on its campus. But notably, it was reported that when Robbie left the Alexandrian Brothers Hospital, the room he stayed in was permanently locked. Hospital workers noted that cold air emanating from the locked room, and they also noticed that there were electrical problems in the surrounding rooms. Eventually, they closed the entire wing. The Catholic Church was instrumental in helping portray the events as they happened. Georgetown's president, Father Haling, gave the producers documents pertaining to the case, and the role of Father Dreyer was actually played by a real priest, Father William O'Malley, in his one and only screen role. Director William Fred King said that the most people at the highest levels of the church accepted it totally because the Roman ritual of exorcism is still in the New Testament. The director claims that the church officials later told him that they credited the film for inspiring new applicants to be priests and nuns. Not what I would have thought would be the outcome of a horror film. Whatever.
Interesting to see if there's ever an uptick in priests and whatnot that after one of those kind of horror flicks comes out where they feature exorcisms and the like.
I don't know.
Where they essentially feature hero priests, if you will.
I don't know. Something to look at.
Yeah.
Now, when the film was released December 26th of 1973, it only opened in 24 theaters across the United States and Canada. People flocked to see it. Some viewers experienced fainting or vomiting due to the graphic nature of the film, and there were even some reports of heart attacks and miscarriages. Despite the R rating, many people took their children to see the film, and the MPAA ratings board was charged by some as going soft on a film that they felt deserved an X rating. Several cities outright banned the movie, while others took extraordinary measures to prevent children from seeing it. It was the first horror movie to be named nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture, one of 10 Academy Awards it was nominated for, and it won for Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Sound. In 2010, the Library of Congress actually selected the film to be preserved as part of its National Film Registry and for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. Question?
No, just people commenting to the effect that The Exorcist truly was a terrifying movie.
I will actually have to admit I've never watched the thing the entire of the way through.
I saw it the first time when I was about 13, I think.
I was earlier than that, and it scared the shit out of me, and I haven't seen it since then. Yeah, it's like arachnophobia. I got about partway through, and I have had a fear of spiders ever since. I think that was the last time I stopped seeing horror films for a while.
Until you met me? Well, no, you probably saw some before
I saw some before that. I love Hitchcock. I like the psycho, the psychological horror. Slashers, not so much.
Olsen never got me that bad.
So, all right. So I'm going to head back to my stomping grounds in Vermont.
Yes. So this is, yeah.
I did not realize this before I did this research.
This is a fun one, yeah. So even though she was born and raised in California and educated in New York, horror author Shirley Jackson moved to North Bennington, Vermont with her husband in 1940, well, in her early 20s. They lived in that town for the rest of their lives, him teaching on the faculty of Bennington College, while she kept house, raised their four children, and wrote horror stories that would become classics of the genre.
Because that's what a housewife does in Vermont, apparently. Not what my mom did.
Now, of course, her most famous work is, amongst many, but her most famous, I'd say, has to be The Haunting of Hill House. Mm-hmm. And it is said to have been inspired by this Vermont school where her husband taught. Bennington College certainly seems to have its share of ghosts, but Jennings Hall in particular strikes a chord when compared to Jackson's novel. Jennings Hall is an old, imposing, gray stone mansion that is covered in creepers. It is very much secluded from the rest of campus, but in an idyllic location up on a hill. All in all, its appearance and setting seem to fit the description from the book's opening sentences. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It has stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. While it wouldn't be unusual to hear music coming from Jennings Hall, since it does house the music department, it's something else entirely when the instruments are played by themselves. Students have also seen heard footsteps and strange voices in the building, and it doesn't bode well that the location of the school is also in what they call the Bennington Triangle, which is known for having people disappear within its boundaries. The Haunting of Hill House has been adapted into two films for the big screen, first in 1963, and then the second in 1999, which I saw the second one. Mm-hmm. It was... okay. And both were called The Haunting, but were very much based off of The Haunting of Hill House. And more recently, it has been adapted into a series on Netflix called The Haunting of Hill House. It is a modern reimagining of the horrifying novel. So, it has it certainly has had its turn through the pop culture from at your real life scary building, Jennings Hall, being turned into the novel, being turned into movies and a TV show. So,
I've been on Bennington campus. I do not remember Jennings Hall at all, but I know I didn't see the entire campus.
I mean, they say that Jennings Hall on campus, it's out there on its own. You really kind of need to follow the directions or the campus map because it's definitely very much set apart from the rest of the buildings on campus.
Now I want to go search for it.
Next time we're up in Vermont, just have to drive through Bennington. Not know that about... Oh, Trina didn't know about the awards that The Exorcist received and was nominated for. Patrick, my mom and dad have stories about pranks and being scared so badly after seeing The Exorcist. It was groundbreaking for sure. The movie is definitely so creepy.
Yep.
Creepy and definitely very much scary.
I'm actually glad I wasn't required to watch it for my film classes.
Allison, dude, I had such a crush on Roddy McDowell in that film. And Patrick, Shirley Jackson also wrote The Lottery,
yep,
the short story we all had to read in grade school.
I've had to teach many times.
I don't think I ever had to read that.
Yeah, I've had to teach it quite a few times. It's also a play. It's been adapted into a play. So.
Oh, Allison, Hill House, not Hell House. Still, Roddy is yummy. Yummy. I'm blend welding hearing firecrackers.
All right, so we're going to talk about the Bathsheba Sherman House, and this is in Rhode Island. So in the 1970s, the Perrin family moved into a large farmhouse in Harrisonville, Rhode Island, They quickly realized it was haunted, and they sought help from the renowned paranormal investigators, of course, Ed and Lorraine Warren. Through historic and paranormal investigations, they came to the conclusion that the house was haunted by a spirit known as Bathsheba. This is believed that Bathsheba Sherman, a woman who was born in Rhode Island in 1812, now by all accounts, she lived a normal life and a prosperous life with her husband. But there's allegedly one dark event that cast a shadow across her entire legacy. At one point, a neighbor's infant died while in the care of her, and it was said that the infant was killed by being impaled on a large sewing needle. I have to think about how big the sewing needle is to be impaled. Yeah, but sewing needles really, unless it was like for a weaving.
Or knitting.
It could have been a knitting needle.
That's what I'm envisioning. That's what I was envisioning from the start, was a knitting needle, okay. Although they refer to it as a sewing needle.
Yeah, it would have to be a knitting needle to be impalable. Anyway, sorry, legalities, logistics. All right, so she was accused of witchcraft and devil worship by her neighbors, and through a court, they actually found her innocent because there was a lack of evidence. Very, very long way from Salem witch trials. Thank God. Now, despite being cleared legally, the community at large was not convinced. And she lived a very long life, passing away in 1885, but this tarnished spot on her legacy just remained. Now, whether she was truly a witch or not is debatable, but the story and the subsequent haunting of the Perrone family provided ample material for the movie that was developed. In 2012, the film entered development known as The Warren Files, but it was later renamed as The Conjuring before it's released in 2013. The film uses real names of those involved, but it did actually take some artistic liberties. The most prominent being that Bathsheba is not only murdered the infant, but that she also committed suicide and cursed the land in the process. Of course, the curse wreaks havoc on all those who lived on the land afterwards, resulting in a long line of murder, suicide, and ultimate Perrone family horror. Now, some interesting facts about this. The house still stands today, but you are not welcome to visit.
Not at all. Do not go there. Do not look it up. Do not go. Bad news.
Yes. They actually have called the police on several people who have tried to go there. As a matter of fact, family that bought the house in 1987 says that they lived in peace until the media fury happened with the movie. After that, they had basically became a target of vandalism. They had numerous invasions of the home. They had objects that were associated with satanic cults being left on the property from trespassers. And when questioned about the lawsuit, Warner Brothers refused to comment on the issue.
So
don't go there.
Yeah, don't go there.
Leave the poor people in peace.
Yes. Although I think those people, I think the ones that sued have since moved out, but still all the same.
The current owners are still facing the backlash of all this as well, so don't go there. Now, the movie states that Bathsheba is a descendant of Mary Easty, a victim of the Salem witch trials, which we all know today to be real-life fiction.
But it made for good movie making, so... artistic liberties a la Hollywood.
Yeah. Now, Rhode Island does not have a law that legally requires a home seller to disclose potential hauntings. In a book that Andrea Perrone, one of the daughters, wrote about the ordeal, she actually states that the man selling the house to her father said, "Leave the lights on at night." That was the only hint he gave.
Yeah. Apparently, the daughter did write and release a book right about the same time that the Conjuring movie came out. So I mentioned that now, and I didn't write the name of the book down, but you can write it up or look it up.
Yeah.
The Conjuring, the Perrone family, and all that stuff.
Yeah. Andrea Perrone.
Yep, all over the internet. But yes, so moving along.
Yes.
Our next one, this one's an interesting one. So if you've ever been out to L.A., you might have heard of the Cecil Hotel. And
if you're a fan of ghost stories, you might have heard of the Cecil Hotel.
So this was built originally back in 1924 and is one of LA's most famous, thanks in part to its dark history. Home to murderers, maniacs, and ghosts, some say the Cecil is anything but your average hotel. They say it's cursed. Over the years, it has also been the site of a string of strange and mysterious deaths. The first documented suicide at the hotel occurred in 1931 when a guest named W.K. Norton took poison capsules in his room. Through the 1940s and 50s, more suicides occurred in the hotel, and eventually longtime residents started referring to the Cecil as the Suicide.
Not a good nickname.
No, no. In 1947, Elizabeth Short, better known in the media as the Black Dahlia, was reportedly seen drinking at the Cecil Bar in the days before her murder. In 1962, Pauline Otten jumped from her ninth floor room, killing George Gianni when her body landed on him. In 1964, there was the unsolved murder of Goldie Osgood, a.k.a. the Pigeon Woman. She was found robbed, strangled, raped, and stabbed inside her seventh-floor room. While an arrest was made, the accused was later cleared, and Osgood's death remains unsolved. Then we get into some that are truly very well-known. You have Ramirez, a.k.a. the Night Stalker, became infamous when he terrorized L.A. from 1984 to 1985, killing 13 women, all of which he did while staying on the top floor of the Cecil. According to tour guides, he would dump his bloody clothes in the dumpsters out back after a night of killing. Then Jack Unterweger, Ramirez's copycat killer, murdered three prostitutes while staying at the Cecil, which many believe he chose as a nod to the Night Stalker himself. Then there is the strange death of Eliza Lamb. 21-year-old Eliza's body was found in February 2013, 2 weeks after her death, when the hotel patrons and staff began complaining that the water had begun to taste and look strange. Her body had been unknowingly decomposing inside the rooftop water tanks for 2 full weeks. I remember seeing the news stories about that.
I do.
That was particularly grim and not that long ago. And it's truly an absolutely bizarre story because an investigation led police to a very strange hotel security video. The video shows Eliza entering the elevator alone, stopping to press the buttons on the panel. After several failed attempts at working the buttons, she exits the elevator and appears to have a conversation with someone who isn't there. She then walks away, and moments later, the elevator doors shut. Authorities believe that after this video was recorded, Eliza gained access to the water tank and drowned. But the rooftop area of the hotel is protected by an alarm and considerably difficult for someone to gain access to, let alone climb inside and close the lid of the water tank. Even weirder is that an autopsy of Eliza's body found no drugs or alcohol in her system. In recent years, what on earth happened to her is a complete and total mystery that, to my knowledge, remains to be solved.
And there's only this one video of her. There's no other security footage of her. So how she avoided any other security cameras, especially the ones going up to the rooftop, is really a huge mystery.
Yeah. So in recent years, the Cecil Hotel has become a hotspot for paranormal enthusiasts who believe the building is haunted by the spirits of the countless people who have met their end in the building. The Cecil Hotel recently tried to rid itself of its dark and gory past by changing its name to The Stay on Main. But unfortunately, no name change is going to wash away the blood-soaked past of one of America's most cursed and haunted hotels. Now, the Cecil is believed to be one of the inspirations for American Horror Story Season 5, which was subtitled Hotel. The American Horror Story Hotel is called the Hotel Cortez and is also situated in downtown L.A. The fictional hotel's timeline also starts right about the same time, started in 1930, so just a few short years after the real-life construction of the Cecil. And much like the Cecil, the Hotel Cortez is a site for blood-soaked death and mayhem. Fun fact, one of the central characters for American Horror Story Hotel is the Countess, who was played by Lady Gaga that season. This character drinks the blood of others to maintain her beauty. Ring a bell, it should. We were talking about it not 20 minutes ago. Lady Gaga's character was also inspired by Elizabeth Bathory, our aforementioned blood countess. So we start having things kind of occurring across each other all over the place here.
Because it's fun.
Yeah, but I have to admit, just earlier this year, I never watched American Horror Story until I binge watched everything up to date over the course of a month or two. And that season was, that one stuck with me. There were a couple other seasons that I've basically already forgotten, but The Hotel, that was a really good season for numerous reasons. Mm-hmm. Interesting story, compelling characters. The set design was absolutely stunning. This Hotel Cortez, they built it on a soundstage. Beautiful. But yeah, if you haven't watched it, I do recommend it. That's me. If you like conspiracy theories or true crime, you've heard of the Cecil Hotel. Yes. Yep. There we go. Sounds amazing that this hotel was able to stay open with a reputation of death and suicide. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a hotel, but it was one of those hotels that eventually actually drew people that really lived at the Cecil. It, you know, it was a long-term stay location for a lot of people. So,
which is what helped keep it open for a while.
Yeah.
But they're also the ones that gave it the nickname, the Suicide Hotel.
Yep. Would love to investigate the sad place. Yeah, I think
I'd be interested in seeing it and going in there to see what I pick up.
Yeah, my understanding, that seems to draw quite a few paranormal enthusiasts, so you probably won't be alone.
Yes.
Never heard of the body yet. Think, but Glenn wants to investigate, but he doesn't think he would stay there. Allison says,
so about the elevator.
Yeah,
game.
She thinks. Did have a mental disorder and thinks she was playing the elevator game.
I'd have to go back and refresh my memory on that.
Yeah.
Because I don't remember what the elevator game was specifically.
Yeah.
But.
And, yeah, I agree, Trina. Definitely, it was one of the best seasons of the American Horror Story. It also inspired The Hotel in Angel.
Oh, good enough. God, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and a little bit of a less direct inspiration for American Horror Story was also the murder hotel that was set up in Chicago during the World's Fair in the late 1800s. But
they kind of combined the two.
Yeah.
So. All right, so let's move on to the Slender Man. Now, we're going to flip the script on this one because it is not a real-life activity that or event that actually inspired this tale. It is a tale that inspired a real-life event to take place.
Mm-hmm.
So this was actually born on the Internet as a so-called creepypasta or a scary urban legend that was built online before it actually evolved into real-life off-screen. The urban myth of Slender Man was created for a harmless Photoshop contest in 2009. A website called Something Awful challenged its users to take mundane pictures and make them scary by adding realistic imagery of the paranormal. Inspired by the surreal imaginings of H.P. Lovecraft, one contestant named Eric Knutson designed a tall, thin, eerie figure, and Slender Man was born. Knutson's harmless creativity was quickly co-opted by countless internet users. Mere days later, someone had made a horror film with a found footage aesthetic that told of young students being stalked by a Slender Man-like figure. New images were made, and the spooky mythos that lived offline was created as well. According to the stories that littered creepypasta forum, Slender Man beckoned children into the forest where he ordered them to kill so they may become his proxies. Now, what should have remained an innocent yet creepy internet tale eventually spiraled into real-life violence. On May 30th of 2014, two 12-year-old girls named Morgan Geyser and Anissa Wire, who believed in the scary urban legend, lured a friend into the woods outside their Milwaukee suburb where they planned to kill her and leave her as an offering to Slender Man. They stabbed their 12-year-old friend, Peyton Lutner, with 19 times and left her in the woods to die. Lutner actually managed to survive. She was bleeding from her torso, arms, and legs, but she was able to drag herself to a nearby path and was discovered by a cyclist who called 911. Geyser and Weiner were arrested shortly thereafter, and, of course, the victim survived. Now, they were later admitted to police that they had planned the attack for months, beginning in December of 2013. Weiner claimed that Geiser proposed the idea, which they both believed would earn them entry into Slenderman's home and a position as his proxies. Their belief in the scary urban legend was so complete and their dedication to police so powerful that they used a kitchen knife to try and murder their friend that they had known since the fourth grade. The state of Wisconsin chose to try the two as adults. Geiser was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and a jury found Weiner not criminally responsible because she suffered from shared delusional disorder. Geiser has since been sentenced to 40 years under institutional care, all because of an urban myth that began online.
Creepypasta. So, yeah, and actually it's kind of funny that that was creepypasta because what their Patrick thinks that the elevator game that we were just talking about was actually inspired by creepypasta as well. So, I honestly have not read very much creepypasta. I might need to because I mean it does, it's kind of up my alley as far as material goes, but it's yeah, kind of very weird stuff. The Slender Man, definitely very disturbing, but as we said, an excellent case of flipping the script where the fiction inspired the real life activities. So
yeah.
I think they made a movie as well, Slender Man movie, which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely very disturbing through and through.
Yes.
But at least their friend, despite the fact that she suffered serious trauma, did ultimately live.
Survive, yeah.
Yes.
All right, so we're going to come a little closer to home.
I was going to say maybe something a little on the lighter side, but that's debatable.
That is debatable.
Guess we'll see.
Urban legend around.
Yes. November 12th. 1966 marked the first ever report of a creature so bizarre and so elusive that it can only be considered the stuff of urban myths. But multiple sightings of the monster that year challenged the notion that it existed only in the imagination. Enter the Mothman. Now, on that fall day in 1966, a Clendenin, West Virginia grave digger claimed to have seen an unsettling creature that looked like a brown human being soaring over his head and moving from tree to tree at rapid speed. 3 days later, four people driving through the nearby town of Point Pleasant saw a gray-winged entity 7 feet tall standing in front of their car. Roger Scarberry and Steve Mallett told the Point Pleasant Register that their creature had bright red eyes and a wingspan of 10 feet. Scarberry said, "If I had seen it well by myself, I wouldn't have said anything, but there were four of us who all saw it." All of the witnesses commented on the creature's speed. One of them claimed that it fled at up to 100 miles an hour and seemed to dislike the car's blinding headlights. The witnesses also claimed that the being chased their vehicle to the outskirts of town before vanishing into a nearby field. The following year saw an ominous increase in sightings across the state of West Virginia. The Gettysburg Times reported on the elusive creature 8 times within the first 3 days of the gravedigger's initial report, which included 2 firefighters describing a very large bird with large red eyes. In another reported sighting, Salem, West Virginia resident Newell Partridge claimed he spotted 2 red eyes staring back at him after his television displayed bizarre patterns, and he went outside to investigate a strange noise. That was the same night that his dog vanished. But there are, of course, skeptics. West Virginia University professor of wildlife, Dr. Robert L. Smith, dismissed the urban legend as a misidentification of the sandhill crane bird. Others are convinced the urban legend was intentionally spread by a committed prankster. There are also those who believed that the Mothman was a harbinger of doom, an idea that was only reinforced when on December 15, 1967, Point Pleasant Silver Bridge collapsed. Cars and pedestrians were plunged into the icy Ohio River waters below, and 46 people died. Author John Keel forever linked the bridge collapse with the Mothman sightings in his 1975 book, The Mothman Prophecies, which was adapted into a film in 2002 of the same name starring Richard Gere. The book and the film have both been met with mixed reviews, but they do have their fans and cult followings. As a matter of fact, Point Pleasant hasn't shied away from the eerie urban legend. To the contrary, the town has created a historical museum on the scary urban legend and constructed a 12-foot-tall chrome-polished statue of the beast. To this day, they celebrate the Mothman annually with a festival.
Place we need to go.
Yes. Not that far.
No, several of our friends actually have been there recently, and every time I see the big shiny statue, I'm like, I need to go.
But yeah, definitely that was a case where creepy, possible urban legend, who knows?
Cryptoid
has inspired some pop culture with the movies and the books.
Yep.
Its own museum now.
Yep. And festival, when it's allowed to be. Anything?
Elson says she'll come over and pull up readings and have a fun creepypasta night.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Something to do this winter.
And Patrick, some creepypastas are very good. What I love is that it gives content creators and independent horror authors an outlet for their work. So many of the stories are narrated on YouTube these days. You can listen to them. Thank you, Patrick. I'm definitely going to be digging around now. Trina absolutely loves the awesome old man. Oh, yeah. Huh. And, and the link to
some creepypastas.
So
we will check those out.
Definitely check those out. Thank you.
All right, so now we're going to move on to one of my favorite ones, the urban myth of Bloody Mary, which actually comes from a real woman. So virtually every young child raised in the Western world is familiar with the scary urban legend of Bloody Mary. Myth has it that repeating the name Bloody Mary in a cramped closet or in a mirror of a dark bathroom will summon the vengeful spirit of a real woman, Queen Mary I of England. Now, some are adamant that Mary's name must be uttered 13 times, whereas others claim 3 times is going to suffice. Some claim that her spirit appears as a woman holding a dead baby, while others insist that she will come after you or your own children. But the terrifying tale is rooted in early history and begins with the birth of the first queen regent of England, Queen Mary I, the eldest surviving child of King Henry VIII. Now, Mary did not fulfill her father's desperate lifelong hope for a male heir, and she was thus ignored by him and declared illegitimate by Parliament. Her life was plagued by pain in addition to isolation. According to Giovanni Micheli, the Venetian ambassador to her court, Mary experienced terrible menstrual pains and irregularity in her cycle, as well as deep bouts of depression. Nonetheless, Mary managed to take the throne at the age of 37 after marrying King Philip of Spain and becoming pregnant with his child. But when her due date came and the baby didn't, the country was in shock. Mary had appeared pregnant, but after her due date came and went, her pregnant belly disappeared as well. The inexplicable false pregnancy coincided with Mary having just signed an act into law known as the Marian Persecutions, in accordance of which 240 men and 60 women were burned at the stake for being Protestant. The despondent monarch came to believe that she had been punished by God for her actions and died childless at the age of 42. Now, besides the sad story of the real Bloody Mary of England, there are other more paranormal tales that inspire a scary urban legend of Bloody Mary. And the most famous is that of a witch named Mary who was said to have been executed for studying black magic. According to this legend, Mary would appear in the mirror during divining rituals in medieval times and seek vengeance. Some believe this is an ethereal mirror. The witch kills her summoner upon arrival, while others say that she drives her victims through the reflective portal into her world. Whether or not Bloody Mary is true, it is certainly sparse in plenty of modern pop culture references. But in an homage to the recently retired TV show Supernatural that just had its series finale this past week, all the way back in the show's very first season, they had an episode aptly named Bloody Mary. And the show featured the ghost of an actress that was found dead in front of her mirror as an apparent suicide, but was likely the work of the doctor with whom she was romantically involved. As a result, the ghost sought vengeance on those who were responsible for the deaths of others. The ghost could only act, however, when her name was invoked in front of a mirror. And two of our guides are very upset that Supernatural has ended.
Very upset. I'm not sure. Allison might be
She might have gone off to study again.
Or she might have gone off to cry, since we brought up Supernatural.
Sorry, Allison. Should have warned her.
But yes. She was, yeah, very, very faint. Apparently she can still type through the tears. The Bloody Mary episode was easily some of the best cam work in the show. I admittedly have to watch it.
Yeah, that's one of the ones I need to watch. I will actually watch that one too.
Okay. I have to find it.
It's on Netflix, but I think it's Netflix. I don't know if it's on Hulu.
I'm not sure. We can always find out.
Yep.
And we can always get a Netflix subscription for a few months if we need to.
Well, if we go into lockdown, we better.
Let's.
Sorry.
Knock on wood. We're not going there.
Well, it is pessimistic today.
Why? Never mind.
No, we're not going to go.
We're not
going to
go there.
Next story.
Next story, because I probably shouldn't have ended with this one. This is truly kind of a very tragic one. This is our last one for this evening, and this one really—it's a good one, but I'm going to leave everybody feeling a little down tonight.
Sorry.
Let's see. All right, so. Though the urban legend of Candyman largely begins and ends with the eponymous, the 1992 horror film, which apparently they are making they're doing a remake. I think so. I thought I saw something about doing another Candyman movie, but it does have a terrifying basis in history. The urban myth of Candyman was inspired just as much by the injustices of racism as it was by Clive Barker's original short story. The urban legend that the film is based on is said to be inspired by Chicago's inner-city violence, segregation laws, and American slavery. The film is also based on Clive Barker's 1981 short story, The Forbidden, in which Candyman was originally depicted as a white man dressed in a patchwork outfit. Set in the slums of Liverpool, England, the story centers on a young woman studying graffiti who finds herself hunted by a deadly figure. The same year that Barker's story was published, the Cabrini Green housing projects in Chicago recorded dozens of murders all in the span of a few short months. The combination of Barker's short story and America's struggle with racism all worked to inspire the scary urban legend behind the 1992 film of the same name. In the film, there is an urban myth that revolved around a former slave named Daniel Robitaille, a successful shoe manufacturer. Robitaille eventually became a respectable painter, and was commissioned to paint a portrait of a white woman named Caroline Sullivan. The pair fell in love, and Sullivan became pregnant out of wedlock. An enraged white mob subsequently hacked Robitaille's right hand off, smeared it in honey, and let a swarm of killer bees sting him to death. But Robitaille returned as an angry ghost and vowed to kill anyone who uttered the name Candyman 5 times into a mirror. He'd appear behind them and kill them with one stroke of a hook fixed where his hand once was. The film took cues from Chicago's violent realities through the 1980s and was shot in Chicago at the Cabrini Green Project specifically. In fact, one particularly chilling murder at the Cabrini Green Project inspired Candyman the movie. On April 22, 1987, a mentally ill Chicagoan named Ruthie Mae McCoy dialed 911 asking for help, claiming that somebody was trying to invade her home through the bathroom mirror. Despite neighbors reporting gunshots thereafter, it took 2 days for authorities to enter the apartment due to a mix of confusion and apathy. When they did finally enter, they found McCoy dead of multiple gunshot wounds. Her killers had, in fact, entered through the medicine cabinet, so they were coming in through the mirror, as she claimed. They removed the cabinet in the adjacent apartment, broke through McCoy's cabinet, and climbed through the wall into her apartment. The urban myth of Candyman is a disturbing example of how the horrors of reality can inspire terrifying fables. So, the case of Ruthie Mae McCoy, it truly is a very fascinating case, not just for the horrific nature of it, but the social nature of it and everything else. There's some, very extensive, interesting articles about it online. Very tragic, most definitely, but very interesting to read about just how, how things actually are sometimes out there, the side that we don't always see.
Yeah, and hopefully learn from.
Yeah.
It's sad when something tragic is what you have to learn from. All right.
Okay. They are doing a new Candyman movie, and Jordan Peele is doing the is in charge. Which,
that's going to be good.
That is fantastic. As much as I love the comedy show on Comedy Central, when I found out that what was the first one, the first horror movie that he did, I'm blanking on it, but I gave it a watch. It was fan freaking tastic. I never would have guessed that. He had such an eye, ear, everything. He's such a talent for horror stories in general. So, yeah, very, very talented guy, Jordan Peele. Trina, I want you all to know that I'm at my cabin on top of a mountain with no neighbors. Might have trouble sleeping tonight. Sorry.
You're welcome, Trina. Sounds like a good night to stay up reading.
Yes. All of it will be on Netflix come Friday.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So good to know.
Oh, excuse me. My beer is talking.
It's campfire.
It's tasty beer.
Stout?
Yes, campfire stout.
I'm drinking a amaretto sour.
Because why not?
Yeah.
Allison, my typos today are atrocious. It's okay. It's just Facebook.
Yep.
And it's us.
So. And yes, Glenn, happy Thanksgiving. We actually celebrated our Thanksgiving a week early, so we're on leftover mode.
Yep. Down to just turkey, though.
Yep. Yeah. And the cranberry sauce.
Yes, that's right. Patrick, hopefully no lockdown, although it would be kind of a nice break for me. Ever since we got back, I have been working a lot and haven't been able to travel. Yeah, it's...
We've been going nonstop. I work 3 days a week, and then I do hunt stuff the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. And yeah, the Glenn, very crazy story, that of Candyman.
Mm-hmm.
And tragic. Yes, very tragic. What? Okay. Oh, the movie. It's like, Get Out. What did I say? The movie, Get Out. Jordan Peele's movie. Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Excellent movie. Yep, I think that was the first movie. And, Glenn, hope you have a very, very good Thanksgiving as well. And, Trina, she's also drinking.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, folks. So we'll be on in 2 weeks.
Yes, we will be back in two
with
weeks.
With Haunted Key West.
Yes.
Because I think we all need a little paradise, and it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yes. I know that we have in past episodes, we've covered numerous things related to Key West, including Robert the Doll and stuff like that, but...
I found another haunted doll.
Yeah.
In Key West.
But so. There is plenty to talk about in Key West, so we are going to make an entire episode out of the stuff that we still haven't talked about for
And
Key
there's
West.
Still stories I haven't written on that, so we might have a round two at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to finish typing that script first. It's written,
there.
I just need to type it.
Got 2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks.
So, but everybody have a good Thanksgiving. If you're going out, please be safe.
Yep. So, cheers, everybody. Thank you for tuning in again, and we hope to see you all in a couple weeks. And as always, any questions, comments, anything like that, drop us a note anytime. We love hearing from you.
Yep.
So, in the meantime, take care. Have Glenn's having a spiked punch with Thanksgiving dinner. Excellent choice. Yes. All have a very happy, safe Thanksgiving, and we will see you in December. Yes, we will see you in December. So with that, y'all have a good night, and we will talk to you again soon.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
For the serious job. all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay. Attentively, I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man dampen his feet. Teeth are extruded and burned to ground and baked into cakes which are passed around.